For those listening to KSBN Money Talk Radio who might be interested in buying physical precious metals for less than what I can pay for them, stay tuned. I have a way you can support this show and secure what I believe is the best price for precious metals on the existing market. In our first commercial break, I will explain this in more detail. And now, let's get on with Reclaiming the Republic. Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. If you go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, you can download our podcast and support documents and links. This is an educational, grassroots program designed to restore the Republic and placing the general government, or what many refer to as the federal government, back into the constitutional framework and scope of the Constitution. Okay, so I'm not sure how many people really had damage from watching the eclipse. However, I just think that there's more than unreported where people actually did damage their eyes because they used sunglasses and they thought that would be good. Or some of those people that used the Amazon glasses that didn't know that they were no good and Amazon was trying to get a hold of you. But anyway, I'm hoping that this causes a whole new market in expanding the eye repair and so forth, because now there's a greater demand for fixing eyes that have sun damage and so forth. So anyway, let me get on to the show here, though. We're also going to have another guest. I've got John Chambers coming on today. He is a Constitution teacher down in Oregon, and I've kind of connected with him on Facebook. And because he's doing good work and we wanted to talk about what he does and how he got started and so forth, we'll be airing that interview going from the second segment on. So if you want to call, please, you know, hold your comments and go ahead and keep emailing me them. And I appreciate that. But we will address those emails next week. And so let's get on with what I do have for the first segment here. And if you can't listen to this entire show, just remember it is rebroadcasted on Saturday at 1. Many parts of these shows refer to each other. And as I refer to a name like Platonist or what have you, and you don't know what that is, by going back and listening to the podcast, you will learn and understand what a Platonist is. Consequently, to stay abreast with what I am talking about regarding republicanism, the 17th Amendment, reclaiming the republic altogether, the only way you're going to be able to really garner all of this content is by listening to the content. So again, you can download these podcasts at reclaimingtherepublic.org on the podcast page. I also have some archive podcasts out there from previous radio stations and guest hostings and things that I've done, but it's on the primary podcast page, and you can actually look, because I put a little synopsis of what each podcast contains. For local announcements, the Republican Coffee Club that meets at 7 o'clock on Friday mornings, they will have on the 25th former City Councilman Mike Allen on. He'll be speaking on entrepreneurship. And the 1st of September, Kevin Cook, the Spokane County Sewer and Water Department leader, is going to be in, and he's probably going to ask and talk about, ask you questions, and he's going to talk to you about how water is the oil of the 21st century, especially the way the EPA has been going after that. Again, the admission is $5 and a buck for the donuts, and it is on the corner of Trent and Hamilton, and it is in the Bangkok Thai restaurant inside the No Lie Brew House. Ed Pace also hosts his weekly weekly town hall meetings, and you can find him every Wednesday, 9 a.m. at McDonald's on University and Sprague, every Friday, 9 a.m. at Forza Coffee on Sullivan and 4th, and every Saturday at 8 a.m. at Rosar's on University and Sprague. The next movie night by Northwest Grassroots will be the 13th of September. The last movie night is still not up that I know of, but once it is, I will let you know, because you'll probably have an interest in downloading or at least watching that, because I go through my executive summaries, and that way you don't have to necessarily worry too much about necessarily reading them. I still recommend you read them because they, one supports the other, but they don't cover the whole thing. And my book is really what covers all of the details of what needs to happen, what we need to do. But the primary solution is in the executive summary, and I speak to that in the movie night with Northwest Grassroots. Well, time is running out. Summer's almost over. And if you still want to make or create a lasting impression, and nothing says it better than a hand-picked bouquet of flowers from the Sunnyvale Flower Farm in Suncrest. So if you go to my website, reclaimingtherepublic.org, I have the details, their hours of operations and so forth there. So if you want to make that impression, do it with some flowers. Again, we're going to have John Chambers on in the next segment, but I just want to also let you know that I am working with Dr. Vile. We're scheduling him to do another call-in interview, and so we'll do a pre-recording of that because it just makes it makes life easier for him because we do it during his working hours because he's in a completely different time zone. But as I was thinking about, you know, him coming back and talking about what he believes has to happen in saving the Constitution or what we need to do to start going back in the right direction, I started thinking about my conversations with other academics and other people that kind of live in that ivory tower or have what I would call the old progressive paradigm of our Constitution. There's lots of people. So I've in talking with Dr. Kimber, Dr. Vile, and even I forget the Arns, I think Hillsdale, he was on the Constitution Radio down in California a while back. But they have this perspective that things are allowed to change and drift and migrate. And I believe that has something to do with the lawyer, the bar association, that club, and you know how they protect themselves in the those who are trusted in interpreting the Constitution. However, there is no doubt in my mind that Madison and Jefferson clearly stated the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions that there was just no way that they signed up for a government to misinterpret or to meander and drift these meanings and definitions. And so I just, you know, I'm kind of curious as to why they believe that, you know, we've been allowed to drift and so we must accept the drifting. And I think, you know, I don't think anybody would accept the drifting that would be against them in compensation in their labor contract. The Constitution is a contract. It's a contract for and by the states, and the states have all the power, but they're just not asserting themselves. And like I've said before, if we can just get them to wake up, stand up, and take their authority that they already possess and use it, they can literally pull this stuff back. I put together a picture that kind of summarizes what Madison said in his veto of the bonus bill. And I think I'll probably try to get into that next week. Actually, I'm hoping to have Stephanie Cates come in and we'll do a recording for next week. But I'd like to get into the Madison veto because, again, I say this in all sincerity, this is the most powerful single-page document that was ever bestowed upon us by our framers. I don't say founders, the founders of the states, the framers, the guys that designed, drafted, and wrote our Constitution and formed it from the ground up. Madison clearly stated in this bonus bill veto that the states had the power and that the federal government couldn't use these what I call mystical clauses in usurping power. So I'll get into that next week. It's a pretty powerful document, and I may not get into reading the whole thing, but I'll do some highlights for you so that you understand the paradigm that the framers had, that you're not allowed to drift this and you can't use these clauses or some weird interpretation to just assume any new powers for yourself. And so in doing that, we'll kind of prove this point that I've been making. And as we come into this hard break, if you check me out on Facebook, that I got that powerful tweet to Trump, by all means, tweet it away. And we will be right back with John Chambers after this break. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back. Okay, so we're back, Reclaiming the Republic, and I have John Chambers with us. John Chambers started teaching the Constitution in 1991 to neighborhood groups, but has managed to teach a few high school classes as well. We don't teach about the Constitution, is what John said, and going through it word by word, section by section, is the best way to study the document himself. When he moved to Grants Pass, Oregon, he started the Josephine County Constitution Study Group, and he worked with local elected officials who have been known to attend, and also local representatives to the state legislature, who also owns the hometown radio station, invites John Chambers for a monthly study group on the air. Mr. Chambers' study guide, The Constitution of the United States, a study guide, going through the Constitution section by section, is used by private schools and by homeschoolers across the country, and it is available at Amazon. Many of these links to John's content at Amazon and his website and so forth will be available on my podcast page, like usual, following the show for the next couple of weeks, and it'll also be permanently on the other links page on the reclaimingtherepublic.org website. John, so how is it that you got started? I mean, how did you learn about the Constitution? Did you go to formal training, just read it yourself?
Very interesting. When I was 13 years old, and it was summertime, and my father sent me down, and he said, "You are not going to waste this summer." And he gave me a composition book, you know, the black and white squiggly cover composition
book. Sure do. They still use them today.
Absolutely. And on the left-hand side, I copied out the Constitution in its original language, and then on the facing page, I would translate it into modern English as much as my little 13-year-old mind could manage. And I went through the entire Constitution at that time. Of course, at the end of the summer, he was so surprised that I'd actually done it. He said, what would you like as a present for being such a good boy and doing this, thinking I'd want a bicycle or something?" And I said, "I want a week at the Smithsonian." And so he arranged that. It was very neat, just going through the Smithsonian for a week.
And let me ask you real quick, where were you living at this point in time? So I can understand the geographic culture that you were being raised in.
I was in Connecticut.
Okay.
My father was in the Coast Guard, and he was teaching at the Coast Guard Academy in London, Connecticut.
Okay. Great, okay.
So some years later, a friend of mine, I was in rural Riverside County, California, up in the hills, up above Riverside, and a friend of mine was running a boarding school there. He wanted me to come over and see if I could write for them a history book that wasn't larded over with a lot of political correctness and so on. And so I started doing that, and I'd be at the school, and some of the kids came up to me and said, "Do you know anything about the Constitution? Can you teach us about the Constitution?" And that's what started it.
So when was this?
That was in 1991.
I'm sorry. So.
Oh, that was in Riverside County, up above, in the hills above Riverside.
Right.
And interestingly, down on the other side of that, of those hills in the valley on the other side, is Temecula, California, which
right.
I found out Douglas Gibbs comes from.
Yes, yes.
And he's been teaching the Constitution down there.
And folks, this is not a coincidence. I just basically connected. Actually, it is a coincidence. It wasn't planned. I connected with John as I realized that he was teaching the Constitution on Facebook. And so we pursued a relationship as far as constitutional studies, questions, and so forth. So anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but what were you doing professionally?
It was very much a coincidence because you're the one who mentioned to me Douglas Gibbs.
Sure,
and
sure.
So I looked him up and found out that he's from Temecula.
Yeah.
And I wrote to him, and he and I have had a conversation going on now of just, about this subject and so on.
Well, great.
So I have to thank you for that introduction.
Yeah, and Douglas Gibbs is a great guy. I mean, yes. He is a true patriot and a true Christian and just a one person. I'm proud to say he's my friend. Let me ask you this though. What were you doing professionally? So apparently there was really no formal education to get a certification or anything like that. So what did you do professionally on the side to actually, you know, put a roof over your head?
Right. Yeah. The way I made my money was, back about 1980, I taught myself how to program a computer. And, then I went around to the local, local places and said, I taught myself how to program a computer. Do you need somebody to program a computer? Somebody said yes, and then I started a career doing that, and then built a business. I worked for Paramount Pictures. I worked for a number of different accountants. I had a number of different clients, and I made my money for many years doing that. And just a year ago, I decided to end off on that, and I'm going to now attempt to make all of my income from just promoting and teaching the Constitution.
Well, good. So I guess the next logical question is, so when you started teaching the Constitution, it kind of led you down a curriculum, and basically what you now have on Amazon is a study guide to the Constitution.
Because when I was teaching those kids in 1991 at this private boarding school in Riverside County, I figured the only way to do it, sort of the way I did it, which is I sat down with a black and white squiggly covered composition book and I just went through it word by word. And so I said, okay, that's what we're going to do. But as I was going along with them on it, I could see that even though they could know the words, they didn't have enough life experience to know the tune. So I would have to fill in part of the tune, and that's what became the study guide, is to fill in for this. And over a number of years, I developed it to a point where, and I saw what worked, what didn't work, and so on. I got to the point where with this study guide, you can just hand it to a kid with an interest, and he can just use it, and he'll get not only the words, but he'll get the tune as well as to why it does it this way.
Okay, so with that in mind, and looking at, I guess, because I don't have a copy of your study guide, I guess I need to get it, but with that in mind, it's more tailored towards, I don't want to use the word novice mind, but more tailored more towards youth and or kids, or is it kind of
discriminate? Well, it is for, I run the Constitution Study Group in Josephine County here, and we use this study guide, and I have grandmothers, and I have laborers, and I have lawyers, and I have all different kinds, and I have elected officials, and they all use the study guide, and it's real interesting to look at the study guides that they're using and see the underlining and the highlighting and so on that they're doing. This is usable for anyone. It was written in mind for high school, but that was high school 25 years ago.
Okay.
And the vocabulary has changed, and so to say high school now, be first or second year of college.
Sure. Real quick though, as I'm thinking about it, what other source documents, before we go to break, what other source documents did you have or did you use, like the Federalist Papers or what, for kind of explaining what these things meant?
I just used the document itself.
Okay.
I said just the document itself.
Okay.
And I also have the Declaration of Independence in there as well.
Okay. Well, I know a lot of people
you know, John Marshall used the document himself, and he pointed out the Supremacy Clause, and he also pointed out the Necessary and Proper Clause. And I think when you look at the document itself, it can easily be, I guess the word is, twisted in the benefit or for the behalf or be for the I'll just use the word benefit, for the benefit of the federal government. That said, let me get everybody hanging on a thread here on what your reply is, because we got to go to a hard break. So folks, please stand by, and we'll be right back with John Chambers right after this.
Great.
Okay, so we're back with John Chambers, and he teaches the Constitution to groups, actual high schools and so forth. And actually has a study guide that's out on Amazon. And before we went to the break, I was asking John how he established his study guide and, you know, what other source documents that he used. And I pointed out that John Marshall had literally relied upon the Supremacy Clause, the Necessary and Proper Clause, and the I hate this when I get my tongue tied. The ambiguous nature of these clauses. Yes, thank you very much. The ambiguous nature of these clauses allowed him to literally subvert the positioning of the general government or the federal government over the states. And so I'll even say this, because I point this out in my work, that John Marshall was present at the Virginia ratification debates. And have you ever read the Virginia ratification debates?
Nope.
Well, so he actually testified during the Virginia ratification debates. And the words that were stated by Marshall, the words were, more importantly, Madison and Nichols and even Randolph and others who were, you know, basically promoting the ratification and the acceptance of the Constitution to the Virginia delegates. It was clear that the federal government was limited and that the Supremacy Clause did not open up any new portals of power, that it only pertained to those things that were enumerated within the Constitution. And Marshall literally, you know, took that and went in a completely different direction. Says, hey, it says we, you know, we're supreme in all things, and we're, you know, there was the supreme law of the land, and if we deem it necessary and proper, then, you know, we can do whatever we want to do, and started creating unconstitutional footings. And so I'm not trying to, you know, cast a negative cloud, but I mean, the Constitution itself should not be, you know, kind of like that last scripture in Revelation. So nothing should be added or taken away from these scriptures, these words. And I get that, but there's a lot of complexity, and they did not do the explanations within the document. They did all of that in the ratification process. So for people to understand what some of that stuff meant and why they did that, you really have to refer to some of those other documents to really provide that detail of fidelity, if that makes sense.
Sure, I can understand that. And as I have been teaching it over the last 25 years, I mean, you asked me when I started out doing start with? What else did I use besides that? And I said I used just that.
Yeah, yeah.
And over the past 25 years, I have gone into a lot of other things, and I have almost always, and I can give you a couple of specific examples, but almost always when there is an expansion like that, as you were talking about, Marshall saying there's this ambiguity and so on, it isn't really an ambiguity. What it is a misdefinition of a word. There's some word in the text that they've decided doesn't mean that. It means something else. And my view of it is, the metaphor that I use, is that they want the Constitution to be a, quote, living document. And what they mean by that is it can mean anything we want it to mean. The metaphor I use, however, is that it is a yardstick. A yardstick is 36 inches long. To tomorrow it's not 35 inches, and yesterday it wasn't 37 inches. It's 36 inches all the time. That's exactly what it is. That is the definition of a yardstick. However, we use it to measure different things. One day you use it to measure how big your room is. The next day you use it to measure how tall your child is. The next day you use it to measure whether or not you can get the refrigerator through the door. So you use this yardstick. It's a living yardstick in that it has different uses, and you are putting life into it and making it work for your life. But it's always 36 inches. It doesn't mean something else. It can't be 35 inches one day and 37 the next. The Constitution is what it is. It says what it says. And the only way that it can be turned into a, quote, living document, as they mean it, meaning something different than what it says, is to misdefine the words. And the redefinition and misdefinition of words is how they manage to do this whenever they do it. And when I have the meetings, in the study guide, and when we go through the meetings and we take a particular section, I go, okay, here's a word, because I found out that there's some particular words that have been misunderstood, and I say, this is the definition of this word, and you look it up in the dictionary, and that's what it is. And when somebody else, when John Marshall or somebody else says it means something else and makes it, quote, ambiguous, no, it's not ambiguous. It's just wrong because they are misdefining it and trying to use it for their own political purposes. I'm sorry, I get a little bit.
No, that's okay. And as a matter of fact, Douglas Gibbs also goes back, and when he looks at the words, the vocabulary that's being used, he'll actually use the Oxford Dictionary and say, okay, what did this word mean, and what was the common use and common understanding of this word back in the late 1700s?
Right, exactly. And I will use the Samuel Johnson Dictionary from 1785, which is pretty good because it's
right.
The exact same time.
Right.
But it's English. It's not American.
Right.
So there's a little problem there.
Same thing with the Oxford Dictionary as well.
And there's also, now I didn't know Oxford Dictionary went back that far.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. And also Noah Webster, 1828.
Sure. And Noah Webster was probably, you know, close enough to where the language did not drift as quickly as it does today. But here's another interesting thing, and I can use a metaphor to build off of your yardstick metaphor. Today, when they ratified the Constitution, it was a yardstick. And then shortly thereafter, it was a yardstick plus 10. And then shortly after that, and today, we have a yardstick plus 27.
Right.
If you want to look at it that way, because the only way something can be added to it is through that Article 5 process. And so,
yes, absolutely. That's absolutely correct. And it is, when it is added to it, it's incorporated as though it were part of the original.
Right,
It becomes, it's not like something that's stuck onto it. It's something that modifies and has to be understood in relation to everything that's already there.
Right.
And where it modifies.
And that yardstick takes on a whole new standard with that modification. So
Right. And if somebody decided and we made it and we made made an amendment and said it's now 37 inches, then from then on a yardstick is 37 inches.
But it's still called a yardstick.
But it's called the yardstick.
Right. Well, let me get on to the next some of the questions that I have regarding some of my content and some of the things that I've been I don't want to say railing about, but pointing out to my listeners. And the first one is the guarantee clause. The guarantee clause within the Constitution guarantees that all states in the Union be Republican in form.
Right.
And I, you know, there has never been, and as a matter of fact, there's been plenty of cases that have gone up. There's been at least three or four that I know of that the Supreme Court has pulled in, and they have constantly and consistently ruled that because this is a political issue, Congress has the jurisdiction. Do you see it any other way?
Well, what we're talking about there is the definition of republic.
Right.
Right. I can't see that the court would have any
jurisdiction on this at all.
Reason to define what republic is, in the same way they can't define what natural born citizen is. That's up to Congress to define what natural born citizen is.
Even though recently they've been defining what carbon is. Carbon emissions. Anyway, you have to throw in these outliers. But anyway, so my point is, and I'm hoping to talk to a couple of congresspersons in the near future, within a month or so, and give them an academic presentation regarding the guarantee clause that Congress can literally go and write an act and have an act passed and have President Trump sign it that could literally change the landscape of politics within our republic, that would, you know, change the direction and guarantee the end of democracy, at least for as we know it, for quite a while. And
what I was going to say is within that, you have to tell them what the definition of republic is, because they don't know either.
No, absolutely. I got to teach them, not tell them. I got to teach them what that is and give them the source documents, as well as getting them to take action on that, because the republic right now has been shifted over to a democracy. And I know you sent me an email on a case. What was the name of that case again?
Reynolds versus Sims.
Reynolds versus
1964 case.
Okay, yeah. And so I did not get a chance to read up on that. I've got a lot on my plate at this point, but I'm definitely going to delve into that. As you can tell, we're out of this segment, so I'd like to hold you on for one more segment and go through the 17th Amendment and Republic Review if you've got a few more minutes.
You betcha.
All right, folks, we'll be right back after this message from our sponsors. Please stay tuned. Okay, so we're back, and we still have John Chambers on the line, and we were just wrapping up the guarantee clause and basically trying to, not coerce, but trying to educate and teach Congress to step forward and create an act in defining what republicanism is, and, you know, basically send the message out and promulgate this to the states to ensure that the states adhere to a republican form government. Instead
exactly
of,
right, and also rein in the court on that as well.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I would love to see that, but that's they could do another Judiciary Act as well, and I've actually talked about that. But
I don't think they need to. I think that all that they need to do is say this is what republic is, and nobody can, and the court is not going to say.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, basically make it constrain the court to what these definitions are. Absolutely.
Because that's certainly within their power. It's Article 3, Section 2, Clause, whichever it is.
Okay. So moving forward onto the 17th Amendment issue that I've been talking about. And I remember pointing out the Amendment Protection Clause with you. And so I'm not sure if you've had a chance. You probably went off and read that the states can't lose their suffrage without their consent.
I have it memorized. I didn't have to go read it at all.
Oh, there you go. And so what I find is interesting, and I've pointed this out to you, I don't think, because of these states, and a lot of people are saying they have to repeal the 17th Amendment, which is a huge bar to do that, because then we need 38 states. I truly believe that all we need are 13 states to move forward to de-ratify, because this amendment was allowed by the government and nobody stepped forward when they said, you know what, you changed your mind and you rejected it and now you want to ratify it and accept it, we're going to allow you to do that. Well, now that means they have to allow states that have once ratified it, if they don't want to abide by it anymore, they can reject it and no longer abide by it.
Well, and in the alternative, I don't know whether or not that would work. I think you have a good argument for it, but I don't know whether or not it would work. But in the alternative, something that you mentioned to me was just if a state says, "Okay, I don't want to do this anymore," then go and just and
start appointing their senators.
start appointing the senators, having the legislature appoint the senators as they used to do. And you have to then ask, well, then what would happen if we did that? What, you know, what shoe is going to fall? What brick wall is going to fall on you if you do that? And I'm not sure what I don't think it can go. I mean, who is going to bring suit against the state
legislatures
for doing that?
Right. The only thing that can happen is it becomes a rallying point for the indivisibles and the radical democratic folks. It'll also force an education of why are we doing this and why is this important. But I think that the only way they're going to be able to really undo that is making it like a plank that we want to, you know, kill babies in the last term of pregnancy, just like abortion, you know, and say, okay, we want to make sure that we subjugate ourselves to, you know, lobbyists and, you know, special interests and globalists and so forth to pipe money into the democratic process so that they can have the best senators money can buy, instead of allowing our state legislatures, who understand our needs in ensuring that those things are protected by our senators in the Senate in the U.S. Congress. And so
and therefore strengthening federalism and actually making the country a stronger country for doing it.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Instead of literally letting somebody come in and basically getting all of their globalist appointments and so forth in there, that's going to sell out the republic lock, stock, and barrel. So interesting. I'm glad you...
Rather than sell out the republic, I would say... turn the democracy into something else, and because if you have a republic, it doesn't get sold out. It's strong and it holds, or at least it should, until it starts being decayed and turning into a democracy. As soon as it turns into a democracy, it gets real squishy, and you can turn it into anything you want.
Right. Well, so we run out of time real quick when we talk about these deep subjects.
Yes, we do. Yes, we can.
But
yes,
let me get back on to the third and final thing, because
yep.
I know you've read my executive summary on Republic Review.
Yep.
And I know you're probably waiting with bated breath on the follow-on of the strategy of how do we pull off this.
Yes.
And so what are your thoughts on the executive summary?
I think that it can be a rallying point, and it is exactly because you mentioned to me last night a point that I had not thought of, which it just turned on a little light bulb in my head, which is that if you just have one state that says it's going to do this, and then it comes out with its report or whatever.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And then other states will look at that and go, oh, maybe we can do that too. I'm not going to say the only problem, but I'll say I see a major stumbling block, which is the same kind of major stumbling block that we have at the local level, is that as soon as you do that, then you're going to lose federal funding. When they lose federal funding, I'm afraid that they're not going to want to let the money go. It's going to take courage and a willingness to stand up on your own feet.
But keep in mind that the other side of this federal funding are the federal regulations that have been inhibiting business and inhibiting states.
I agree. I agree.
Okay.
And it can be sold.
Oh yeah.
I'm not saying that it shouldn't be done, and I'm not saying that it couldn't be done.
But right.
What I'm saying is that this is what people are going to look at is, oh, we're going to lose this federal funding.
Right. And so the one thing I mentioned to you yesterday, because I said I would mention this today on air,
sure.
Because you know it comes down to education and who needs to be educated, and my point in contention is that if we educate our leaders, our local leaders and our legislatures, to do the right thing, to get us out of federal tyranny, then even though there's lots of people that won't understand it and they're going to bellyache, they're going to go, what the heck's going on? But as I alluded to you yesterday, it's like cancer when it first hits the family. A person has no idea what melanoma or what non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or any of these types of cancers are. And so what do? You know, they go, hey, we're at war with this thing and I need to get smart on this. And the patient, the victim, and the family and loved ones immerse themselves in the, you know, what is this and how can we stop this? How can we beat this? You know, and or how can we join this if it's a good thing? And so by one state coming on board, it will create a mass need for education, and that education has to be a follow-up to this.
Yes, I agree. So you have to start out with the seed education in I don't know, Wyoming or wherever.
Right.
And once that seed then takes root, then it will start to spread.
Absolutely. And it will spread like, I believe my metaphor is like a grass plains wildfire, and it will just, as the wind blows it, it'll just keep on carrying it, and it will light up, I believe, the Republic's landscape to a point where people will go, you know, end the tyranny, you know, give the states their, you know, their sovereignty back, and give the states, you know, the constitutional authorities and powers that they were supposed to have.
Absolutely.
I do know we're kind of running out of time, but what are there any other parting thoughts on Republic Review?
I would like to see it move forward.
Have you ever heard of anything in a similar vein or concept?
Well, we spoke before about Tom Woods and
nullification. Correct, right?
It is kind of a distant cousin to that.
Kind of.
But it is something that I think this is probably more. This is probably more workable than that, because we had nullification all the way from, you know, 1798, where there was an attempt at nullification,
sure.
And then New England states, and then we had the Civil War, which was just a big attempt at nullification, and they got beat back real bad. And since then, nullification has been kind of sort of a taboo subject.
Yes. Well, so as you can hear, we've ran out of time, but I'll say this. Nullification and Republic Review are both Madisonian principles and thoughts. John, thank you so much for being on the show. Folks, we'll be back next week. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye
you.
Now.